Hello, my name is Neil Ferguson, and as chair of the Hoover History Working Group, it's my pleasure to welcome Andrew Roberts, who's been giving a talk at our virtual seminar on what Winston Churchill's relations with Russia can teach us for today. And nobody's really better placed than Andrew to give a talk like that, as the author of the best-selling biography, Churchill Walking with Destiny, which won the Council on Foreign Relations Arthur Ross Prize last year. Andrew, welcome back to the Hoover Institution. You're a favorite here as the Roger and Martha Merz Visiting Fellow at Hoover. Somehow or other, you are relating Winston Churchill's relationship to Russia with the five stages of grief. Explain.
Yes, you'll remember the... thank you very much indeed for inviting me on, by the way, Neil. It's a great honour, needless to say. Yes, it struck me that, very forcibly actually, that we can see the five different phases that Winston Churchill's relationship with the Soviet Union goes through, from the October Revolution in 1917 all the way through to the end of his life, in terms of the famous Kubler-Ross five stages of grief: denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance. And each of those form chronologically an explicable area of his relationship with Russia.
So let's start with denial. This was Churchill's indignant and very hostile response to the Russian Revolution.
Exactly. Not just because he was an aristocrat, who, of course, were he Russian, would have been shot by the Bolsheviks, but also because he was a democrat who hated the concept of a totalitarian dictatorship such as the Bolsheviks were setting up. He was also somebody who was a moral figure, and who recognized in communism something that, as he put it, was corrosive to the human soul. And so he was angry and stayed angry, and actually wanted... Sorry, he was in denial and stayed in denial until really 1921. He did everything he could possibly do to, in his words, strangle Bolshevism in its cradle. He supported intervention in the Russian Civil War on the side of the whites to try to destroy the Bolsheviks. And when the Lloyd George government did not go along with him, and he was Secretary for War, it was a devastating blow for him.
The second stage is indeed the anger stage. And you observe that some of the most vitriolic journalism that Churchill ever wrote was about the Bolshevik regime after it was clear that it couldn't be overthrown. Talk a little bit about that.
Yes, he called it a bacillus, a virus. He equated Lenin's going across Germany during the war as a sealed train, like cholera, a file of cholera, he called it. He used the crocodile analogy an awful lot, actually, when it came to the Russians. To the Bolsheviks, at least. He was in a state of fury and anger from about 1921, when he'd got over his denial, when the Reds had won the Russian Civil War, all the way through, really, until the mid to late 1930s, when he recognised Russia as a possible ally in an even worse and more terrible and more immediate threat to Britain, namely, of course, the Nazis.
So the bargaining phase of the cycle was in many ways the most important, because, as you pointed out in your brilliant biography, which everybody should read, that ultimately what Churchill had to do was to strike a bargain with a crocodile. Talk a little bit about how that came about and what its consequences were, because they were profound.
Well, once it became clear that he was not going to be able to persuade the West to do a deal with Russia and effectively contain contain the Nazis and to have a cordon sanitaire around Nazi Germany, and couldn't sort of block in the Third Reich. Then after that, of course, came the Nazi-Soviet pact. And Churchill really just had to wait until the 22nd of June 1941, when Hitler invaded Russia at Operation Barbarossa. And immediately, what he did, by then Prime Minister, of course, was to offer a full-scale alliance with the Russians, even though he had spent the previous two and a bit decades denouncing at every opportunity Soviet communism. He overnight wanted it to be Britain's ally, because, of course, ultimately the worst threat was Germany. So he started bargaining. He bargained all the way through the Second World War from that point onwards with Stalin, went to visit Stalin twice in the Kremlin in August 1942 and October 1944, and they bargained in ways that many people, many historians, many moralists have found to be completely unacceptable, frankly, carving up countries in Eastern Europe, deciding that Greece was going to stay on the side of democracy, but Romania and Bulgaria effectively and Poland were going to fall behind the Iron Curtain. And so there was an immense amount of bargaining that went on, coming to the ultimate apogee, of course, at the Yalta Conference of February 1945.
I have a wonderful image of Churchill at Yalta throwing open the doors of his room, stepping out on the balcony and declaring, "Ah, the Riviera of Hades," one of my favorite Churchill lines. Tell us about stage four, depression.
Yes, well, he got very depressed, of course, from the point at which the high hopes of Yalta, that Stalin made promises that he was going to respect the independence and integrity of Poland, for example, which he had no intention of doing. Basically, Stalin spent the whole of Yalta just lying to Franklin Roosevelt and Winston Churchill, and neither of them could do anything about it, because there were a million Red Army troops in Poland at the time, and they couldn't be dislodged. So the best that Churchill and Roosevelt could do would be to pretend to believe him. And they've been accused of naivety over this, and I have to say they did make some pretty naive comments. And so as a result, when it became clear very early on that they had been lied to and they could do very little about it, the inevitable next stage in the Kubler-Ross declensions of grief was depression. And you see this very much in the immensely depressive and depressing speech that Churchill gave at Fulton, Missouri, the Iron Curtain speech, in which he talked about how the Iron Curtain had fallen across Europe. But as well as the depressing aspect of all of this, he at least also recognized how important it was to fight the Cold War and to be strong. And he said again and again that the only thing that the Russians really understood was hard power, or at least what we call hard power today. And he was no longer after that in the slightest bit naive about the realpolitik that underlined Russian interests.
And finally comes acceptance. You argued that in many ways, in the final phase of his political career and his premiership in the 1950s, Churchill was no longer a state of denial, of anger, of bargaining, of depression, but he was essentially accepting of Russian superpower. Am I right?
Yes, that's right. And this happens, you can get it almost down to the day. This happens in April 1949, when the Soviets announced that, and he'd known that anyway, of course, earlier before from British intelligence, that the Soviets had successfully detonated a nuclear device in Siberia. And so the Stalin had the bomb. And the only thing to do after that was to accept and to realize that that any dreams he might have had of blackmailing the Russians into giving up Eastern Europe because of the possession of the nuclear bomb on behalf of the Western powers, but not Russia, all of that was over. And instead, he actually started to accept Russia, to appease Russia to a degree. He opposed the anti-Russian stance of both President Truman and Eisenhower, and wound up thinking of Eisenhower as something of a warmonger, even though he, of course, personally had liked Eisenhower enormously and did like Eisenhower, and they planned D-Day together and so on. And so it's a very, it's very much the last phase of his time, but nonetheless, the phase that when he was prime minister from October 1951 to April 1955, he continued with this idea of a grand European settlement that would, world settlement, essentially, that would mean that that Russian domination of Eastern Europe was accepted. Although privately, on one occasion, privately, he did say to his private secretary, Jock Colville, that he believed that although he himself would never see the Russians out of Eastern Europe, that actually he thought democracy would come back to Eastern Europe in Jock's lifetime. And Jock died in 1987, only 2 years before the fall of the Berlin Wall.
Andrew, part of the beauty of your biography of Churchill is you see the power that historical knowledge can give a leader, and that this really was Churchill's superpower, that he saw everything through the lens of history. It was the thing that gave him an advantage over his opponents in the 1930s debates. And I was thinking, as I was listening to you earlier, that in a sense, we've gone in the reverse direction since the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991. We've actually started with acceptance. We all accepted that Russia had become a democracy under Boris Yeltsin. Then we got rather depressed when we realized that it hadn't quite worked out as well as we'd hoped. Then we started to bargain with Vladimir Putin, thinking that we could do business with him. Then we got very angry when it turned out that we couldn't do business with him. And I think now we're in a state of denial about what that implies. So hypothesis, we have just driven in reverse through the five stages of grief. And where do we go from here? I mean, it's something surely has to be learnt from all of this that could give us a future path for relations with Russia, which at this point are in an impasse, it seems to me, regardless of who is president of the United States or prime minister of Britain.
A brilliant analysis, needless to say. I think that's absolutely right. There was a moment when Churchill was walking through the Westminster Hall on his way to the coronation, to the present Queen's coronation in June 1953, and a young American came up to him and asked him for some life advice. And Churchill said, study history, for therein lies all the secrets of statecraft. And which, by the way, of course, could completely be the leitmotif of your working history seminar group here at Hoover, needless to say. But I think that's the answer, really. You mustn't mistake Vladimir Putin for Joseph Stalin. Of course, he is responsible for some pretty terrible things, but Putin has not been responsible for the murder of millions in the way that that Stalin was. And if you study history and you look at who Putin most looks like, it's really the czars of the past, isn't it? It's not the previous Soviet leaders particularly. He is he's the new czar. You've just got to work out which one. Is he Alexander I, the defeater of Napoleon? Is he Napoleon? Is he Nicholas the First? Is he going to, is Azerbaijan going to be something that Alexander II might have done? I don't know. I think you can pick your czar, frankly. But I like the idea of us having reverse through the Kubler-Ross five stages of grief. I think there's a lot to that.
We can decide which of us writes that particular op-ed offline. Andrew, it's been great pleasure to welcome you virtually back to Hoover, and we look forward to welcoming you back in real space as well as real time in the post-pandemic period, whenever that should begin. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. I've really enjoyed it, Neil. Good night.